Thanks for listening to Talk Radio 1210 WPHT On Demand.
Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Delaware, and Maryland. So, hey, how y'all doing? Give me a call on the line at 855-839-1210, 855-839-1210. I'm going to go right to my interview with Pennsylvania's own Senator Dave McCormick. We got into a lot of things. So you want to listen to that? Give me a call, 855-839-1210. Hit it. Senator Dave McCormick, thank you so much for joining me.
Hey, Kathy, great to be with you as always.
Yes. Well, listen, we are living through extraordinary complexities here at home. We're grappling with deep division. We're dealing with an administration that is moving at warp speed, confusing a lot, but who believe they are fulfilling a mandate. But then if we take a spin around the world, there is tremendous tension that's not just simmering, but brewing. And I earnestly believe, especially here in Pennsylvania, but even, you know, across the nation, your perspective carries a tremendous amount of weight and insight on what is happening. So if you don't mind, I'm going to just jump right in. And let's start with going around the world and land in the Middle East right now. I know, you know, everyone is glued to what is happening with Yemen and the Houthis. But over the past 72 hours, there's been a massive buildup of military equipment, specifically the highest concentration of B-2 bombers in Diego Garcia. What is your opinion on that buildup of strategic bombers on that island? And what message do you think is sending not only to the UTs, Yemen, but also to Iran?
Well, you're on top of things. I'm trying to keep up with you in terms of the Diego Garcia and the bombers. Well, listen, you've put your finger on, I think, the most uncertain and volatile part of the world. And, you know, I'm on a couple committees. I'm the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and I'm actually the chairman of the Middle East subcommittee and the counterterrorism. And I think what's unique at this moment, there's obviously what's going on with Gaza and Hamas, but there's Iran's proxies continue to sort of seek terrorist activity and destabilization around the region. And Hezbollah and Hamas have been significantly reduced in their capability, but the Houthis still, you know, continue to pose a threat to the traffic in the Red Sea, which is a huge shipping lane. And Iran is in a very weakened state. And that weakened state creates opportunity, but also uncertainty. And so the big question, I think, is what to do with Iran. They're at a weakened point in terms of their ability to support terrorism. But they're also on a path to a nuclear capability. And right. So if you're Israel, you don't want a neighbor who explicitly threatens to destroy you to have a nuclear capability. And the question is, at this moment, what should we do in terms of dealing with Iran? Should we use this moment of weakness to try to negotiate some sort of reduction of their nuclear capability and use the power we have? Or should we use this weakened state to try to eviscerate any possibility? And that's the debate that I think is going on right now. My own personal view on this is, I'm not sure which of those two paths, but I come at this with a deep degree of skepticism about our ability to trust Iran and our ability to even have an agreement where we would have confidence they would hold up. If Israel is going to take action against Iran, which some say they should, some speculate they will, then the second question is, what role will the United States play in that? Right. I think having resources aligned creates the most options for the president, including taking on the Houthis, which he did a couple days ago.
You know, there are many in the administration who have characterized the attack on the Houthis as really a precursor to a broader war with Iran. And now with the buildup of military assets, again, B-2 bombers, tankers, a lot of other things on Diego Garcia, let me just ask you more pointedly, are we preparing for a war with Iran?
You know, I honestly don't know. I mean, the part of the administration's success will depend on its ability to keep its plans very, very clear. I don't agree with your premise that taking on the Houthis necessarily leads to war with Iran in the following sense. Iran's been funding these terrorist proxies, Hezbollah, the Houthis, Hamas. And so the Houthis rather are directly attacking U.S. flagged ships. Mm-hmm. They're directly taking on U.S. Troops. So I think it would be very justifiable for us, as the president did, to go after the Houthis, and also mean that that's committed us in any way to move on Iran. So I'm not sure what the path is. I think the president, in his typical fashion, is probably keeping open a wide range of possibilities, because on one hand, he's saying and is initiating a discussion with Iran through the letter that President Trump wrote to Iran. We don't know what was in that letter, but he certainly reached out. And on the other hand, he's saying that it's unacceptable, and I agree with him, it's unacceptable for Iran to have the threat of a nuclear weapon. And so how we navigate this will be interesting, but I'm really not sure. Having the ability to exercise either option, I think, is smart politics and probably smart geopolitically.
Yeah, exactly. Let me move up and go to Europe. I don't know if any of us, maybe you were aware, but I don't think most Americans were aware that during the past 3 years, the war between Ukraine and Russia, that in fact, no one from the Biden administration had ever paused long enough to have a conversation with Putin. And now it seems like we may be on the cusp of some sort of peace agreement, whether it is just concerning the Black Sea right now or what it may be. But I think it forces the broader question of what if Russia and Ukraine can come to some kind of agreement, some sort of pause. It forces the larger question of why wasn't this done before now, before we spent $300 billion, before 2 million lives were lost in both sides of this war, and before Putin ran into the embrace of Xi Jinping. What were your thoughts, your opinion, when you found out that no one in the Biden administration had even paused long enough to have a conversation with Putin?
Well, I think the Biden administration really was at the heart of the fact that we're even in this war. Essentially early in office permitted the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which allowed Russian gas to go to Europe and sort of empowered Putin. And then second, the debacle in Afghanistan, I think also made Putin think, I'm up against a weak leader. This is my time to move on my territorial ambitions. And you know, I'm of the view that that it is time to bring this conflict to an end, and that President Trump is uniquely positioned to do that. You know, our party is very divided on this, Kathy. As you know, I was someone who said I thought we should support Ukraine with military aid in its fight against Russia, because I believe indisputably that Russia was the aggressor here. And I believe that was in America's interest to combat that aggression. But at the same time, as Ronald Reagan did, and Ronald Reagan called the USSR the evil empire, and was also the person that was the first willing to talk to them about how to bring peace to the region. And so I think it was a terrible mistake not to be engaged with Putin. And I think now with the outline of President Trump, the deal he said, I think Zelensky in the Oval Office was really lacked grace and gratitude. But what President Trump's outlined is essentially a three-part deal, which I think is the key to peace. One is, you got to stop the fighting. You got to stop the killing. It's been terrible for the Russian people. It's been terrible for the Ukrainian people. Number two, Europe has to step up. Every president in the last 20 years is saying NATO needs to play a bigger role. The Europeans need to be at the source of the security agreement with Ukraine. They have to double down on their defense spending. They're starting to do that because President Trump is demanding they do that. And then the final thing is, I believe that the economic arrangement that President Trump proposed makes sense for both sides, because it helps pay back the American people for the.
Are you talking about with the mineral
with
deal?
With the rare earth deal. Mm-hmm. It helps pay back the American people. But on top of that, that creates a further deterrent. If American companies and American mm-hmm. workers are on the ground in Ukraine, that helps ensure the sovereignty and that Russia won't be aggressive in the future. So, you know, there are different views of how we got here and different views of what should have been done. I think we can come together that this is a moment to bring peace to the region. It's in America's interest, Ukraine's interest, European interest. And I think I'm hopeful and I believe President Trump will be the guy to do that.
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely agree with you that there are a number of reasons on how we got to this moment. And the focus should be on what do we do now. But, you know, I'm like you. I love history. You and I used to talk. I mean, you and I were actually more closely aligned on this issue of Ukraine when we were actually competing with one another. But, you know, Donald Trump's time in office will come to an end. We do have this, whatever you want to call it, this deep state kind of mechanism around the world that actually has their own plan and ideas. I just want to go back and double click on something. Putin does not come to this Ukraine war with clean hands. But do you think it's not just about what Putin decided to do, but what weight do you put on the fact that there is this move from the West of expanding NATO? Do you think that had anything to do with the reason for this war? Do you think if we weren't trying to expand NATO that Putin would not have entered Ukraine?
Well, it's hard to know exactly what the weight of these different things are, but I agree with you 100% that those who, I mean, listen, Ukraine is in a different category in terms of how the Russians view it. There's a history, as you know, there's a number of Russian speaking Ukrainians in Donbass region and elsewhere. So there were a number of people who were advocating, a number of people in the United States, a number of people in Ukraine, in Europe, that were advocating Ukraine become part of NATO. And of course, when Ukraine becomes part of NATO, that solidifies, it reinforces Article 5, which means any attack against Ukraine is an attack against NATO and all of Europe. And I think that was a mistake. I was never one who advocated that. When Ukraine gave up its nuclear weapons in 1993, there was an agreement that the United States would stand with Ukraine. But that wasn't an agreement, nor should it have been, in my opinion, to bring Ukraine into NATO. And so I think that certainly contributed to the sense on the part of the Russians that Ukraine may change its status in a way that would be unfavorable to them. But, you know, listen, there's some debate in our party. I am on the side of the fact that if we're going to assign blame for the aggression, that it falls more squarely on the feet of Putin. But I do think this talk about NATO made a very precarious situation a lot worse.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. Let's come back home now. We have this trade deficit. We are now paying $1 million in interest on this. We have a
trillion.
I'm sorry, did I say a million? A trillion dollars. At this point, million, billion, trillion. It is just ridiculous what it is that we're paying on this debt. It's $36 trillion, a trillion dollars in debt interest. I appreciate what DOGE is attempting to do, but the reality is much of what is being spent has already been appropriated. And it is not attacking the four larger buckets of expenses, Social Security and Medicaid, Medicare, all of that, as well as this interest payment. And I do believe that, you know, if we're talking about national security interests, most people don't talk about the national debt, but I do believe it is a problem. You guys have a vote that's going to be coming up pretty soon on tackling this debt. What are your thoughts as you enter into this?
Yeah, you've described it perfectly. We are on an unsustainable path. We have $34 trillion of debt. As you said, we have $1 trillion a year of interest payments. If you look at just this year, just think about it this way. We have $6 trillion of expenses just this year, and we have $4 trillion of revenue. So it's like a family that makes $100,000 a year. They're spending $150,000. That's not going to work for very long, right? That's not a sustainable path. And so we got to bend the curve. And listen, you can blame Joe Biden a lot. It's $5 trillion of incremental spending. But I think, Kathy, you and I agree, we're both willing to criticize our own party.
Yes.
20 years of Republicans and Democrats in office, and this has gotten worse and worse and worse. So the big thing that's happening now, and this doesn't happen, it's only happened four times in the last 80 years, is we have an opportunity for something called reconciliation. That is when the White House is within the hands of the Republicans. The majority of the Senate is Republican, and the House is Republican. So all bodies are Republican, and that allows you to do something where you can make decisions without a 60-vote majority in the Senate. You only have to have 51. And what I think is going to happen is we're going to be in a position to make really significant reductions in spending, and we have to do that to pay for a bunch of the things that President Trump promised. President Trump promised border wall. President Trump promised he's going to increase defense spending. President Trump promised that we're going to extend and make permanent the tax cuts, which are pro-growth. That's putting money in your pocket. If we didn't go forward on that extension, your taxes would go up. A family of four that makes $50,000, their taxes would go up $2,500, which is a big deal. But we're going to have to find ways to reduce costs. The Government Accountability Office has estimated $500 billion of waste, fraud, and abuse. And here's where the DOGE thing becomes valuable. The DOGE thing isn't going to find $500 billion of expenses. But what it showed the American people, and I think that's why we're going to have support for some of the tough cost reductions we're going to have to make. It showed the American people that their money is getting spent on a bunch of crazy stuff that the large majority would not agree with. The, you know, foreign assistance, the LGBTQ stuff that's happening.
$50 million for condoms in Gaza.
Exactly. This is madness. And so that's what we're focused on. The president promised, and I agree with him, that
you should not
reduce the benefits of Social Security or Medicare or Medicaid.
Yeah, do you want it all?
Waste, fraud, and abuse that's happening. These programs are blowing up because in some cases they're being
misused. You should be able to see
me. Biden, hundreds of billions of dollars, trillions of dollars of subsidies for charging stations and windmills and solar panels. We have to use reconciliation to stop that ridiculous spending. Student loan forgiveness, $250 billion. You know, if you worked your way through college and paid off your loan.
Which I did.
I remember that. And you're, you know, if your best friend
was and
still had $30,000 of outstanding debt. That gets forgiven. That's not fair. So we're going to have to make some tough calls, but I think there's a path. We're not going to solve the problem overnight, but the test, I think, when you have me back on your show in 6 months, we should look and say, did we start to reduce spending?
And just to double click on, you said we have some tough cost reduction decisions to make. What are some of those cost reduction decision that you're already kind of percolating in your mind?
Well, the things I was just talking about. So, for example, eliminating all those subsidies, people are getting money in their pockets. Those are creating jobs in some cases. They're also distorting the economy and creating inflation. You know, the waste, fraud, and abuse, you're going to have to go in there and make sure that the people that are getting the benefits are actually legal to get the benefits. That's going to be very disruptive. So it's going to take a lot of scrutiny. A lot of the benefits are going to people that have entered this country illegally. The fact that we allowed somewhere, I'm not sure where the actual number is, between 10 and 20 million illegal immigrants.
20.
Okay.
Probably more.
Into the country over the last 4 years, that's added huge expenses. So We're going to have to go after things that, you know, have been let spiral out of control. And it's going to take some real focus.
Yeah, I know you have to go really soon. But let me just ask you, you know, I appreciate Donald Trump and the executive orders and all of that. But it kind of feels like a two-step dance, right? We take one step forward and then this judicial branch, typically lower court, takes us two steps back, right? And so we're really not winning as much as some would say we are. Are you of the mind that we are living through perhaps a judicial coup? I know Bukele just mentioned that in Argentina. He would probably know what a judicial coup looks like. And now we have the Trump administration looking to people like yourself saying maybe we need to start impeaching some of these judges. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, I think there's no doubt, and we saw this judicial system hijacked politically in the last administration in its attacks on President Trump. In its essentially the politicization of the judicial branch in support of the executive, and we saw that to use to the detriment of Republicans. Republicans attacked, and so I think when President Trump says that, he's absolutely right. The other thing President Trump says, though, which I appreciate, is that the path through resolving these issues is the court system, where you appeal the judgments. And ultimately, the process will right itself. So I want to use the impeachment language carefully. And the reason I say that is it's got a very specific meaning. You can't, in my opinion, impeach someone because you disagree with them. You have to impeach them because they've conducted themselves in a way that's inconsistent with their mandate and responsibilities. And the reason I'm so sensitive to it is it was used politically against President Trump on multiple occasions. So, we're not, I'd like to believe that the Republicans are going to be in charge for the rest of my life, but knowing the way politics swings, I don't want to set a precedent where we're using impeachment in ways that it can be redirected back at Republicans who Democrats disagree with in the future. So,
Do you believe that there are some judges who, I mean, like there's right now, I think we're averaging about 2 lawsuits a day. We're over 130 lawsuits against this administration. Do you believe that there are some judges who have misused?
I believe there are some judges that may warrant impeachment. I do.
Okay.
I do
believe. So you're open. So you're not ruling it completely off
the table.
And
there's a methodology and a process for impeaching judges who are guilty of misconduct. So I'm not arguing against impeaching judges who are, but I'm saying let's be careful, because impeachment can then become politicized, as it was against President Trump. And so I want to use, and President Trump said that, which I appreciate. He has said,
right,
we will follow the decisions of the court and appeal those that don't make sense. I think he's got the balance right.
Okay, last question. We just had a special election here in Pennsylvania. It did not go our way. A reliable Republican seat in an area that Donald Trump won with a significant margin just got flipped to Democrats. We're now, I believe, 2 Senate seats away from Pennsylvania looking like California.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I have my own thoughts of what that may mean for Pennsylvania being one of those pivotal states during a 2028 election. What are your thoughts? Do you think, I mean, because Democrats are just so horrid, and everything that DOGE is uncovering, do you think that their rallies and their rioting and all of their antics is swaying or galvanizing, getting out the vote on their side and discouraging maybe those who may be a little bit more sympathetic to us?
Well, I think it's a little too early to tell, but let's make no mistake. That was a terrible outcome, and it should be an absolute wake up call to every county, every state seat, every Republican in Pennsylvania. Go back to November. We had an historic win. Obviously, President Trump at the top of the ticket helped a lot.
As well as you. I mean, you toppled a dynasty here.
Right. And President Trump helped me. I think I helped him on the margin. But it was because we focused on voter registration. We had huge success on mail-in ballot. We had an incredible turnout of the voters. Our team was aligned. We had good candidates that could win and took out. We were on message. I don't think those things happened in this race. If you look at the turnout numbers, they're very disappointing. So here's what I hope. You know, we came out of the election in November feeling like there's a huge path to turning Pennsylvania red. Kathy, when you and I were running, there was something like 600,000 more registered Democrats than Republicans.
Right.
There's 180,000 now. If you go to the active ones, there's about 100,000 more active Democrats than Republicans. We have a path to continuously. But when people say to me, what about the grassroots or this? It is all one team. We have our differences within the House.
I agree.
But generally, we are aligned that the crazy progressive left is going to destroy the country unless we win these races. And what you see is national money coming in. There was national money that came into that Senate race. Mm-hmm. I think we got complacent because it was an R plus 20 something and a right. Trump plus 15. And that should be a canary in the coal mine. We can use this. It's like my old wrestling career, right? If I got beat early in the season, it makes me strengthen myself, get in shape, bring back the eye of the tiger. We need to get the eye of the tiger back. And if so, we're going to have great success. If we yeah. don't, we're going to get what we deserve.
I absolutely agree with you. I am a conservative through and through. I don't even pretend to be anything other than that. And yet I come to this moment and I have changed a lot of my own thinking that we yeah. have to work together. Yeah. And we cannot allow our ship to sink. So that we can stand on some kind of principle that if the yeah. other side get in, they're going to yeah. demolish it. We've already seen what they're going to do.
Well, and you and I had that. I mean, you know, you and I had differences and you had concerns about me and we talked about them openly. You said, listen, I think you're running a good campaign. I'm going to get behind you, even though you were very clear that there were some things you weren't comfortable with. I appreciate that. You know, listen, we're not going to agree on everything as a party. And we can't have such division of views in our party that we're not coherent around the most important things.
Yeah.
But we got to get together to win. And I think that's what key to our success going forward.
I am so happy for you, Dave. I really am. I am very grateful that you won. And I am looking to support you. And we'll be encouraging others to do the same. Keep it up. We appreciate you.
Thanks for having me. Have a great day.
Thanks for listening to Talk Radio 1210 WPHT On Demand.
You can also follow me at Kathy for the number 4 Truth. Kathy, number 4 Truth. I'll go over there and help me. Thank you so much, Kimmy. I appreciate that. I'm looking at Kimmy over here on YouTube, you guys. I can also see you if you go right out to YouTube right now. Kimmy just said, great call with Dave McCormick. Kathy, yay. I am so excited about all of that. Yes, great seeing them working together for a better PA. That is right, Edward. We have to work together, guys, because what we just saw in Pennsylvania in that special election, that should wake everybody up. Not everyone, but everybody. Everybody should be awake right about now and figure out some things, right? Because what we're doing is not working, and we don't have Elon in the state like we did last year. Make no mistake, Elon was a very big reason on why we won. Not all this other minutia people like to try to rewrite history. No. So we're going to have to figure out some things so that we are not in an upside down position. We're 2 seats away from Pennsylvania, looking very much like California. So I don't care if you're hurt, your feelings are hurt about what I just said. That's the reality. And we need to figure out what it is we need to do. And I'm talking to you, GOP establishment. I'm talking to you, my grassroots fellow patriots. We're going to have to figure some things out. So with that, I want to bring in my good friend, someone I truly enjoy, and every time an article comes out, I get my hand on it. I'm in your amen corner, Mr. Joe Penland. How are you doing, sir?
I'm fine, Kathy, and yourself?
I am doing well. I love talking to you. I actually feel calm when I'm talking to you. I feel like I'm talking to someone who's been through some things and you can provide some perspective. You guys are familiar with Mr. Joe Penland, Joe from Texas. You can also find him out there at Twitter at Joe from Texas. He's a businessman turned political activist. He was one of the main sponsors of Tucker Carlson Live Tour that traveled all around the nation. That was a part of our big win last year. I know when I walked into that conference, Joe, that you were a big sponsor of, I felt things shift in my own heart. So I know as you guys traveled around the nation, you were bringing that same kind of inspiration and fight to the rest of Americans.
Well, you could feel a lot of excitement, Kathy, in every city. As you just said, you came to some of them, and it was really an amazing thing to see it transform over time, that people were just really lining up to get in those facilities. They were very much impressed with the different speakers that Tucker had. I was just really pleased to know that that many people were leaning back toward where they need to go. Come home. Let's be real about what's going on in this country. You know, when I talk to people there, you know, encouraging them to make sure that they find what they really want in life. And what they really want in life is to be good, solid Americans like this country has always been. Get so far. Look, I don't care if we just stay in the middle. And that's fine. In the middle is okay. But when you get so far over to the left that everything that's brought up, no matter who says this or that or whatever, it's good for America, they're against it. And what that's got to stop. You know, Reagan said, if we ever forget that we're one nation under God, then we'll be one nation gone under. Mm. And I think that is something America needs to look at today, because we're real close to that. And had we not been successful winning this election, if the president hadn't got back in office, if we didn't have the House and we didn't have the Senate, this country was in jeopardy. And it just, you know, you got to face the facts. And I think it was overwhelming that people knew that they had to make this choice, and they made the right choice. And I think they're going to be very happy about their choice when they look at this situation we're in, move it 4 years down the road and see what the president and his team comes out with. I think all America will actually be proud of what we've done.
Yes. And, you know, and let me just double click, because, again, it's no small thing what you and what you, with the Tucker Carlson tour, what you guys brought to the nation, because I think it was encouragement. I felt hope again. And hope is no small matter, because it was feeling very discouraging. Most of us who have been on the front line fighting, we were getting exhausted. And then this particular tour came, I walked in, and it felt like, wow, this is the America I remember. And it was packed. I mean, it was packed. Every seat seemed like it was filled. And so, and you were a big part of that. So I'm so very grateful that you got into this fight, which is one of the things I want to kind of pivot to. Something else you just said is that just because Donald Trump's name is attached to it, the other side is like, nope, we don't like it. We hate it. It's horrible. But when you look at what it is that he's doing with the trade tariffs, with bringing in investments back into this country, it just makes sense and is healthy and good. I think I'm being told I have to go to a break right now.
We have 30.
Do I have to go to a break? Okay. Yeah. I'm sorry. I'm talking to my producer right now. Yes. I'm going to play that clip in a moment. But listen, I want your take on this, Joe, is that if Donald Trump says it, automatically it's bad, it's horrible, but it's good. Who doesn't want to bring investments back to this country? There is a death by despair that is going on in our middle class right now. What are we watching?
Well, they're not going to embrace anything that works because they don't want to give President Trump any credit, no matter if it hurts America. And that's where it's really sad. And I hope that's where 340 million people focus in on, that the other side, the left, is not for the American people. They're for their party and themselves. And they'll do anything to stay in power and make the other side look bad.
You know, I heard someone say that the left is not, Democrats aren't just fighting for survival. They're fighting to stay out of prison.
Well, that may be true. You know, I think whenever Elon gets through looking at everything, I think there'll probably be some surprises, you know. And, hey, it is what it is. You know, if you do something wrong, doesn't matter if you're in politics or not, you need to be punished or you need to move on down the road. And I think that would be something that's going to happen. I think there's going to be several of them when you get right down to the end of it. I think if they open it all up for us to look at, America's going to be real surprised.
And I think that's the reason why they're fighting so ferociously right now and encouraging others to do so. But let me turn to your article that just came out in Newsweek, I believe. A tariff that could rebuild U.S. manufacturing. It is such a wonderful article. You guys, you need to go out there and take a look at it. And yes, it is, in fact, on Newsmax. A tariff that could rebuild U.S. manufacturing. Because I think one of the problems with the American population is that they don't understand the significance of these tariffs. And so as such, you have people fighting for Canada, fighting for Japan, when they should be fighting for America. There's a significant transfer of wealth that has taken place as a result of the imbalance in these tariffs. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, you know, the president is right, putting these tariffs on some of these countries to get our trade where it's more balanced, where our companies in this country can compete, because things are unfair. There's no two ways about it. But, you know, whenever we see these new plants being built, these new car plants being built, these new fabricating shops being built in America, it's going to be literally hundreds of thousands of jobs are going to come available that we don't have today. But the problem with that is we've got 8 million jobs in this country we can't fill today. Now, that's not me saying that. That's the United States Chamber of Commerce in December 24 said if every man and woman took a job that was hunting a job, took a job in their field, we'd still have 8 million jobs that we couldn't fill. So when you add 10 more million jobs to that, we're going to have a labor shortage that's really going to create a problem. So it's a balancing act that we bring our manufacturing up as well as we bring our workforce up. And the only way to bring your workforce up, we can't wait for children to be born. That's 20 years down the road plus. So we have to go back and embrace immigration like we did during Ellis Island. But we need to do it right. We need to control our borders, and that you always need to control your borders. And you bring people in this country that want to work and be good citizens and do it the right way. I'd rather have a tariff on a man or woman working in the United States today that the employer paid to keep that man and woman here. If they're good people, we need to vet them, make sure the right caliber of people working here. I'd rather pay that tariff here than to pay a tariff, charge Japan or China or some other country a tariff. Those people are working there. They're buying their food there. They're buying their work gloves there. They're going to work. They're helping that economy. If we bring those people here, some people here, the right people here, let them work here, then it's going to be a double plus for us, because then we'll have the economy here, but yet we're going to have their income being spread into our neighborhoods. Now, they'll send a little money home, but that's better than sending all the money home by buying something made in Japan.
I think I think you're absolutely right. And I haven't heard anyone present this. Maybe I have, like, just in passing, but I think you do a really great job in writing it out here in this Newsmax article, a tariff that could rebuild U.S. manufacturing. And I think, you know, I mean, we're going to have to be informed, and we can't rely on the Wall Street Journal to give us the unbiased truth. We're going to have to go out here, find good people who are speaking in a way that makes sense. I think your article does just that. I have to go to a break. Can you hold on one moment, Joe?
Yes, ma'am.
Awesome. I'll bring you back on the other side. I want to talk about Doge. Elon just did an interview with Fox News, him and half of the Doge team. There's a lot of good that's coming out. So let's talk about that on the other side of the break.
Thanks for listening to Talk Radio 1210 WPHT On Demand.
Mr. Penland, let me bring you back in. The U.S. national debt is well over $36 trillion. And again, this kind of goes hand in hand with what you brought up earlier about there are just some people, just because Donald Trump gives the idea that they don't like it. But this is unsustainable. $36 trillion U.S. national debt. We're running a $2 trillion annual federal deficit. right now, the interest that we pay on this debt is over $1 billion. You know what? Maybe $1 trillion. I think it's $1 trillion. Yes. $1 trillion. It's just crazy. We pay over $1 trillion in interest on our national debt right now. And Elon is saying, I am working to reduce the federal spending by 15%. He said he is his mandate is to reduce the deficit by $1 trillion. At the rate he's going on, they're cutting about $1 billion. They're saving us about $1 billion a day, $7 billion a week. He said within 130 days, he is on track to achieving a reduction in our debt by $1 trillion. Who doesn't like that?
Well, they ought to like it. They ought to like the fact that he's scrubbing names off of the Social Security. People's been dead. He's cleaning up a mess that's been brewing for a long, long time. And America has grown too big. It's promised too much. It subsidizes too many. And there's a lot of corruption, too. So I applaud what he's doing. I know a lot of people are afraid. But I think, you know, when the people that are afraid are, one, not informed, or two, maybe they need something to be afraid of.
I know, you know, one of the things he said in that Fox interview was that he said the question was asked, what's one of the more shocking things you've discovered since working at Doge? And he said just how casually we waste money. He said, on average, we waste about $1 billion a day. And it's just a casual kind of thing. And he gave the example of a survey, a 10 question simple survey that would generally cost $10,000 to do. Our government paid $1 billion to do it.
Well, you know, we've been hearing stories like that all my life, what a toilet seat cost in the military and what you know, anything costs. It's just and now we finally have somebody digging in to prove all of those things. It's been right for a long, long time. You know, what's happened over the years, though, we've gotten ourselves to where we owe a lot of money. You know, when this country was really humming manufacturing wise and everything, maybe we could afford to be wasteful, but we can't. And it shouldn't have never been that way. We should have had a surplus all the time. And then we'd be ready for when there is a war or when there is a pandemic or something like that. But we've been running way too close on our budget for many, many years. You know, it took us 205 years to get to $1 trillion in debt. And like you said, to echo what you said, now we're paying $1 trillion in interest. And this has happened. It's really snowballed after President Clinton. You got to split it right down the middle. It's Democrat and Republican problem. But we have went, you look at $5 trillion when Clinton got out. When Bush got out, it was $10 trillion. When Obama got out, it was $19.6 trillion. It just keeps doubling. You cannot do that. Our population hasn't doubled. Our amount of politicians haven't doubled. So where is this money going? It's going in waste, abuse, and fraud. It has to be.
Yes, and it's going out of the pocket of the middle class. And there's been a $23 trillion exodus of our money to the rest of the world. And when you talk about Clinton, you got to talk about like it started happening with Clinton. What happened then? Oh, we brought China into the World Trade Organization and started shifting all of our manufacturing. Let me end our time together, because one of the things that really stood out when I talked to you, when I was watching this interview with Elon Musk, is that there's a lot of billionaires on that stage. And the running theme with the Democrats is that these billionaires hate you. They're taking all your money. They don't like you. They're not one of you. And yet, from the moment I met you, Joe, you've been talking consistently about the middle class, the working poor, and saving Social Security. How do you do that, sir?
Well, you have to save Social Security. That's arguably the best program, most liked program America's ever had. And it's for Americans. It's not for the wealthy. It's not for the poor. It's for everybody. It's right straight across the board. And if you took a 20 or 25% cut, if we don't do anything to it over the next 8 years, we're going to double the poverty rate overnight.
Thank you so much, Mr. Penland. Go find him, guys, at joefromtexas.com.
This is Talk Radio 1210, WPHT On Demand. On Demand.